traditions and celebrations. They're not the same thing, but they kind of overlap.
Right.
And so there tends to be, but this is, you're making me realize this is one of those things that's sort of ambiently around that I actually know surprisingly little about.
We are some prepared for this episode.
Is that your intro music?
Yes.
Does that mean you replaced my intro music?
Oh my God, no, I will never.
But maybe yours is better. Yours kind of sounds like newscaster.
It's not news. It's Halloween.
It feels like, but it feels kind of like that, like the John Williams NBC News.
What is that instrument? Is that like a keyboard?
Yeah, all John Carpenter music is very synth-based. Various keyboards, especially 80s, like DX7 kind of, but even just piano.
Yeah, I don't remember. I watched it a long time ago. It's way higher than that.
Well, I'm working with what I got here.
You have a piano next to yours.
It's too far to reach.
Oh, my God. Hello, Austin.
It's like you rebooted. You're like, hello. Hi. We begin our gothic horror month.
Gothic horror? I think just in general horror.
Hallows Eve.
Hallows is like the saints. It's like the good souls, right?
Well, hallowed refers to things like, my understanding, when you refer to something as like hallowed grounds, it's sort of like sacred, something that should be like held in high, like reverence, you know, like, because something horrible could have happened there, you know, like Ground Zero in September 11th can be considered hallowed grounds because something of tremendous, of not just horror, but also something of major significance happened there. But you could also refer to like the birth of this, the Ballet Russe in Paris, where the Rite of Spring had its world premiere. You could argue that's hallowed grounds.
I think it comes, Hallows Day, Hallows. How is it called that day? November 1 is Hallows Day.
Which would make sense why the night before is Hallows
Exactly. Eve. Because you're supposed to believe that the spirits, the night before, they just are just coming back to their grave or something. I think. And that's why people...
I know
that's how it started. They started to dress up as... Undead.
Yeah, and it's also in America. There's an interweaving of Dia de los Muertos traditions and celebrations. They're not the same thing, but they kind of overlap.
Right.
And so there tends to be. But this is you're making me realize this is one of those things that's sort of ambiently around that I actually know surprisingly little about.
We are some prepared for this episode.
Well, we're not an educational. lecture right. Series.
You're right. I'll take that.
I never hide from the things I don't know when doing public facing podcasts.
Yeah. As you should be.
Well, you see so many people that are like, they just speak so matter of factly as if they are an authority figure on whatever topic. And I'm like, even areas that I know pretty well, like the history of Hollywood or film scoring or video game music, things like that. I will always say, don't trust me. I'm sure I'm wrong about plenty of details.
Don't ask me. I'm just a girl.
Yeah, exactly. That said, to kick off our month of hallowed conversations.
Guys, we decided to make the whole month related to horror stuff. So for today's episode, we're going to talk about horror movies. And yes. I'm very excited because I think you're obviously you are the one that brings all the stories. I guess it's usual, but more but more maybe. On this one.
I don't know.
You pretty much cover all the cinema history period.
Well, I think that's too strong of a statement, but I do love the subject, and I've scored a handful of horror films, which means that, you know, horror, the kinds of directors that make horror films tend to like be people that are deeply educated in the genre. You don't typically see there's not a lot of horror movies that are made by random directors that are kind of casual about the genre. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They don't like pretty much every horror film I've worked on, the directors know the history of horror film deeply. They know all the directors. They know the little indie obscure ones. They know the famous ones. And so just working with people like that, I end up absorbing
right.
a pretty good amount of info over the years. Because, mm-hmm. you know, horror films are also one of the only genres of movie that low-budget, independent ones that have no big stars can be hugely successful still.
Yeah.
You know, it's not true. Like, you couldn't make an indie superhero film that's, like, not Marvel and not $100 to $200 million budget.
It is hard to think on examples, but I think obviously one of those, I guess this is a very bad example, but I was thinking about Cobra Kai.
But Cobra Kai is not what, like, that's a project, like, the initial season was made for YouTube, but it's using the original actors from an existing IP.
Right,
that's
exactly.
Like a
that's
beloved
why I think it's
80s
a very
property.
Yes.
It would be more
we can't
like
generalize, but I believe there are a few examples.
It's just near impossible to compete in any genre except horror, as a low budget nobody. Basically, it's very right. very difficult because, you know, intimate dramas and character films and things like that are, you need a big star typically for them to get noticed, because otherwise there are just so many of them out there. Same mm-hmm. thing with romantic comedies, et cetera, et cetera. There was one horror film, superhero film that was. Not really a superhero film, but it was kind of like quasi in that genre, that was called Super, that had Rainn Wilson in it. And it was like, it came out around the same time as that movie Kick-Ass. And mm-hmm. it had a very similar kind of vibe as like very, like kind of like The Boys, you know, sort of like an anti-superhero right. movie mm-hmm. and very kind of like darkly funny and stuff. And Rainn Wilson was really only known as Dwight on The Office. And so it was pretty much an indie movie in that space, but and no one really knows about it unless you happen to be a fan. That's like the only, and so it's like not particularly successful, certainly nowhere even in the same universe of success as the average MCU movie. So yeah, horror has always been one of the interesting places where people can be very kind of creative and weird and dark and interesting and not big budget and not any big famous people and still do well. So it's a much deeper well. If you mm-hmm. become a fan of horror, there's a lot more places to go. So yeah, it's a fun place to work as a composer, because you actually realize, like, oh, you know, this might get seen by people. Like, yeah. this might, like, even though there might be no famous people in this film, like, when you're just starting, horror tends to be a common place for composers to begin.
Yeah, that's, I was going to troll you, but I guess I'll just pass for now.
What? Well, now you have to.
No, I was just going to talk about Evil Death.
Oh, Live Evil?
Live Evil. Yeah, yes, Evil Dead is something else.
Evil Dead's a perfect example of what I'm talking about, though, where Evil Dead was super low budget indie made for no money by no one famous, and it caught fire and launched an entire franchise. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a TV show currently. There were multiple movies. It's a pretty huge IP that was started on something that was made for, I don't even know, like $100,000 or something, like maybe even less than that. I mean, the original, and when you go back and watch the original, which I did a couple of years ago, it.
Oh, really?
It truly is like the jankiest, most low budget sort of schlocky.
I mean, I guess it's not rare. Oh, a lot of horror.
It's just amazing it was successful as it was. When you watch it, you're like, oh, dear Lord. Yeah. Or like we watched recently the movies that made us about like, which one was it? Like Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street?
Yes, and I think Halloween as well.
Yeah, and you realize all of those started insanely low budget and a bunch of nobodies, you know, none of them had big backing. They all start that way.
Yep.
Those were great episodes. All
I
of
can't
them.
Believe we realized that was Johnny Depp.
Yeah, I never, if I knew it at one point, I had since forgotten because that caught me by surprise.
Yes.
That was really funny.
Here, I have a question for you. Which one is your favorite of all?
Favorite horror film ever?
Ever.
It's hard not to go with like the, you know, the seminal classic. Like, it feels like such a cheap answer, but I really do think Psycho is one of the greatest films ever made.
Ah, nice. Yes.
It feels like it's not cool to go with a super famous movie. It's cool to go with a thing that's super obscure and la la la. But
right,
the truth is
like,
that movie
like,
is just
like
so
let
masterful.
The one in. Or,
let the right one in, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like for example, there's a Japanese horror director named Kiyoshi Kurosawa who has made some really, really amazing, unnerving films, most of which got really lame American remakes in English and stuff. But I remember Paul Sollett, a director who has made multiple horror films that I've had the pleasure of scoring, turned me on to a movie called Pulse, which had a really cheesy American remake, but the original Pulse is all about like people's soul. Canvas is very needy. Does she need to go out?
I hope not. I'm just going to close the door.
So yeah, Paul turned me on to this Japanese director, Kiyoshi Kurosawa. His movie Pulse was really creepy and interesting and cool from like 20 years ago or so. And then a little older than that was a movie called Cure. That's also kind of like a detective murder mystery horror film. Both of those are really atmospheric.
Yeah, I'm just going to say it blatantly. I'm a coward for that stuff. And I don't think I ever seen any Japanese horror movie ever in my life. I've seen
they're not like, you know, the famous like, you know, The Ring or The Grudge, you know, those are very like classic, very visceral. Cure and Pulse both were very atmospheric, like very a lot of just like a detective, like in the case of Cure, he's in an environment.
I think it's more like psychological. I think you're more into that stuff, I guess.
It's psychological for the audience. I mean, it's not psychological horror from the angle of being about like a tortured, but that's like Psycho. You know, I'd call Psycho in a way psychological horror. Or like there's this great film with Anthony Hopkins called Magic from I think 1978, 79 about a schizophrenic ventriloquist. Has a crazy, awesome Jerry Goldsmith score, but that's like a psychological horror film. That's a movie about a disturbed mind. Whereas these are maybe more psychologically disturbing for the audience. Like they let your imagination wander. It's kind of like when you're in a dark room and there's moonlight coming through a window and you see shadows and you start to really invent images from those shadows. It's a movie that's built on that level of the brain. So it's not that it's about a disturbed mind, but your imagination starts to see things.
I see
things.
What you mean.
I think it's awesome. I haven't watched, I don't think any of his other movies, but so yeah, you know, it's like, those are great. I love that kind of film. I know that we disagreed. I liked Let the Right One In for similar reasons. It's a movie that lets you kind of soak in the bath of its mood. And I like that.
I don't remember much about it. I just remember that the ending was very unsatisfying, but I don't remember much.
Well, it's kind of like this cross of a young sort of adolescent love story and a kind of vampire horror film. But yeah, anyway, I to me, Psycho is just a timeless classic that I'll never forget. I watched it as a kid. I was probably too young, but I watched it. And that, spoiler alert, everyone who hasn't seen Psycho really should go see it. That moment where they turn the chair around and it's her skeleton was so striking to me as a kid. I mean, it like ripped my chest open. I mean, it was just so impactful.
Yes.
Never mind the fact.
I felt the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think I was a kid, though. I think I was a teenager, but I remember I was like, holy shit. This is serious. This is no wonder why it was so popular.
And Hitchcock, it's got such a powerful backstory. Like, you know, Hitchcock was such a big deal already, but he couldn't get that movie made. And because everyone said, you're going to take your famous star and kill her in the first 15 minutes of the movie. Like, it seemed like a box office
disaster
waiting to happen, you know. But he was like, I want the audience to realize no one is safe. You know, if right. you have...
what a statement.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. Just the sheer courage filmmaking-wise. So my understanding was... because no one would believe it, he paid for that movie out of his own pocket. He self-financed it. And the other thing he wanted to do was in black and white. Psycho's from 1960. It's not like movies were all black and white anymore.
Right,
so
right.
he did that as a stylistic choice. And that also made people go, but color's the rage. Like, we're still enjoying the fact that color is a relatively recent phenomenon. He was like, nope, this is a black and white movie. And that's also as a side note trivia, that's why Bernard Herrmann famously wrote the music as just string orchestra, because he said the music should feel black and white, and if you add woodwinds, if you add brass, if you add all these other sounds, that's like the equivalent of adding in color, but just strings is like black and white music. That was his sort of justification for a string orchestra.
I would never think that strings are black and white.
Well, I think you could maybe, if not black and white, the argument would be monochromatic. Because
right.
strings are the only subset of orchestral instruments where you can cover really high notes in the violins.
So, wait. This score is all just violins?
It's strings. It's violins, violas, cellos, basses.
Oh, okay.
But the point is that, like, it's a continuous... The color of it is the same from top to bottom, which is why it creates the impression of being monochromatic.
I see.
As opposed to all the diverse colors...
Right.
Of the woodwinds, the brass, the percussion, et cetera. That was, I think, his justification. And it makes total sense to me as a reason to do that. Another really famous Psycho score story was Hitchcock told Bernard Herrmann explicitly, do not score the shower scene. That needs to be all about her screams, the sound effects, the rapid fire editing. You know, that was one of those scenes that was pretty revolutionary for how many camera cuts happen in such a short amount of time, so that they never actually show blade entering flesh, but you're 100% convinced you see it because the camera's moving around so much and you hear this very famous sound of them like chopping watermelons and stuff. And Herrmann, of course, watched the movie and said, well, that's wrong. It needs score. And he went and wrote what is arguably the most iconic piece of film music in the history of cinema. The only thing I think that comes close is Jaws. Yeah. Like, they're very similar to each other in that they're not melody. They're just like a sound effect.
Right.
And yeah, so the story goes that during the recording sessions, when Hitchcock first hears the music and hears all the like da-da-da-da-da, bum 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 and all this stuff, he realized, oh my god, this is so much better than I even thought it could be. I should have had Herrmann write music for the shower scene. And Herrmann essentially said, well, I ignored you, I did anyway, and here's what it sounds like. I'm sure that's slightly mythologized and romanticized, but it's something close to that. He definitely was told not to do it, and he did it anyway, and it made the film. I mean, it's literally the most famous music maybe ever. And so, yeah, that to me, that film, it's sort of a cliche answer, but it's just so perfect. I remember also one last little piece of trivia was that they made a sequel in the 80s, Psycho 2, and Anthony Perkins comes back as Norman Bates, and Jerry Goldsmith did the score. Bernard Herrmann had since died. Goldsmith, Herrmann was mean to everybody. He was like an old curmudgeon, and he didn't particularly like Jerry. And so Jerry was conducting the recording session to Psycho and reportedly said something to the orchestra like, if Benny were alive and knew I was doing this, he'd be turning over in his grave because probably, you know, would hate the fact that I, of all people, am scoring his legacy, which I always thought was funny because, like, if ever there was a, you know, a composer who actually could rise to Bernard Herrmann's level, it was Goldsmith. because Herman is absolutely one of the greatest in the history of cinema and most creative and most original. In any case, so yeah, Psycho 2. I never saw Psycho 2, though. I listened to the score, and it's quite nice, but I never bothered with it. I don't know if it's actually regarded as a decent film or not, but how can anything compare to the first one? So that's my answer. It's a long answer. I'm sorry, but there you go. What is your answer?
I, again, have a list for you. I wrote...
You have a list for me of your favorites?
Of my favorite, yes. I have 13 of my favorite movies of all time. And I'm going to describe them to you in a very short sentences and very vague.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. This is going to be an interesting challenge.
I probably forgot. There's so many options, though. It's so hard to decide. But yeah, here's the first one. Number 13. Dad buries his son in the wrong place.
Pet Sematary.
Yes. Do you have any stories for that one?
I know that it is essentially the first real score by Elliot Goldenthal. I think he did one or two movies before that, like maybe I want to say Midnight Cowboy, but basically that's sort of his first sort of like claim to fame, although it's nothing compared to he did Alien 3, which is very arguably a horror film as well, for David Fincher not long after that. That's clearly a more significant film. But Pet Sematary is one of those. And funny, I said Midnight Cowboy. I always mix it up. Cocaine Cowboys was the name of the movie, which he did, you know, many years earlier. Pet Sematary, 1989. Drugstore Cowboy. What's with all these cowboy movie names?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Drugstore Cowboy was the movie I was actually thinking of. I don't know if I even knew what Cocaine Cowboys is, but that's apparently Goldenthal's true first score.
Okay.
From 1979. Okay. But then, yeah, 1989, Pet Sematary. And there was a recent remake of that that I didn't see, that my old friend and staple of the horror genre, famous for Hellraiser, Chris Young, did the score for.
But nice.
I did not hear his score nor see the movie.
Wow, okay. The only thing I remember about watching Pet Sematary is that that was the first time I knew about the Ramones.
That's so funny. See, I first learned about the Ramones, I'm embarrassed to say, from The Simpsons.
Oh my God. Yes, I think you're right. I think that was actually before that.
It's just so classic. Have the Rolling Stones killed. Sir, this isn't the Rolling Stones. So funny. All right, number 12.
Yes, 12. Rustic local folk with leather-decorated dining room have a guest for supper.
I don't know. The way you described it, I thought it was going to go somewhere else, and it didn't, and it kind of threw me for a loop, and now I'm drawing a blank. I can't think of it. Sorry, but I don't know.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, of course, duh. The leather thing was such a tell, but my brain was going to, like, Silence of the Lambs-style, like, skin suit. And so I was like, that's not leather, though. And so I couldn't get off of Silence of the Lambs. And of course, yeah, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There's another one that got a remake not that long ago that was produced by Michael Bay.
I didn't see that one.
Neither did I. I remember starting to watch it because I was demoing. The director was Marcus Nispel, who was the director of the Jason Momoa Conan the Barbarian remake that I was demoing for Lionsgate. And so I was like, I should watch this guy's other movies. And I started to watch it, and then I was like, the phone rang, and I never finished it. Oh, and I didn't get the job, so it didn't matter.
Oh.
Well. So that's 12.
Yeah. 11. A scientist who tries to invent teleport machines crave for trash. Well, I couldn't find a better. That got me thinking.
Craves
for a while.
Trash.
Yes.
That's such a funny description. That is very clearly The Fly.
Yeah, that is probably one of the first movies that my mom recommended.
Oh dear Lord.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
horror movies. I mean.
That's the remake, the famous, the one that's more famous than the original with this Jeff Goldblum.
Yes, 1986.
Yeah, because isn't the original like from the 50s?
Yes, it's a very old one.
Yeah, but the Goldblum is the one everybody knows, and
of course.
The scene where he snaps the guy's wrist was one of those that I saw as a kid that absolutely just burrowed into my soul forever.
Yeah, I know. I remember my mom was like for an entire week, "You should watch this movie. You should watch it.
Oh my God,
it's
so
nasty."
She hates you.
No, she was amazed by it. I remember, I think the scene that got me like you know, chills on my skin, and like I just felt horrible when he pulls the nails
to fall off
and
yeah, it's full of a lot of those. There's another moment in that where he's like lying in bed and he rolls over onto like a sharp object, and when he pulls it out it leaves behind a scratch, and then the healing like grows the like fly hairs out of the like wound hole. And that always
I don't remember
stuck with
that
me too.
Yes, it's just not yeah, it's been a long time, but there are some things that I will never forget. Obviously the makeup is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I just love practical effects so much that I admire that kind of work.
Well, and the horror genre is just like a deep well of amazing practical effects.
Yeah, for sure. Here's number 10. If you fall asleep, you die.
what's his name? I always used to conflate Freddy Krueger and Michael Myers as a kid for some reason. It's like I watched those like on the same weekend or something.
That's weird.
So my brain always blurred them together. But
yeah, Robert Englund, and we see him again recently on. What was it?
And Jason also.
Oh, on Stranger Things.
On Stranger Things?
Yes.
He was in there?
Yes.
As who?
He was in jail because he was accused
to kill
his family.
Yes, Victor Creel. Yes, of course, the guy who gouged his eyes out.
Ah, exactly. And that's a little, like, poke of, you know.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. I totally forgot that. Yep. In any case, yes, Nightmare on Elm Street, music courtesy of Charles Bernstein, a very lovely, nice man with whom I had the great pleasure of serving on the board of directors for the Society of Composers and Lyricists for a number of years.
Nice.
Really, really nice guy. But I liked that they actually interviewed him and featured him in that Movies That Made Us episode about Nightmare on Elm Street. They actually interviewed him.
That's so cool. I like that show so much.
Oh, yeah. It's great. How old is he? He's almost 80 years old.
Amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
Number 9. A short lady with a weird voice tries to get a little girl out of the TV.
Poltergeist.
Yes.
Yes. Poltergeist, one of Kenny Hall's treasured collaborations with Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, that's so cool. Yes.
Because he got to work so closely with Steven Spielberg.
Wow. That was 1982.
Yep, Spielberg was making Poltergeist and E.T. exactly at the same time. So he was literally simultaneously working with John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, and Kenny Hall was the music editor on both films simultaneously.
That is awesome.
So it's basically, 82 is essentially the best, most challenging, but like in a way creatively the best year, I think probably ever of Kenny's life.
Amazing.
Just, you know, two great classics, one of which is truly an all-time great classic, both with Spielberg, who he loved.
Amazing.
So yeah, Poltergeist is classic.
Here's number 8. It's like Clue, but you have to find the alien.
What? Clue, but you have to find the alien?
Mm-hmm. This is super vague, and I will be very impressed if you get it.
I mean, the only movie that's even close to a horror film that came to mind was Close Encounters, but that's not really a horror film. But there is a vague sense of find the alien you could kind of say about that movie. It's like Clue, but you have to find the alien. So I'm guessing this is like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or something.
Is that something?
Do you not know that movie? Oh, come on. Oh, man. Yeah, of course. It's the idea of when aliens are disguised as humans, essentially, and it's sort of a paranoia thriller of you don't know who is human
and
who's not.
Really? Let me look it up. Invasion?
They had a remake of it a few years ago with Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig that was called like Invasion or something like that. But the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Body Snatchers, okay.
Yeah. Late 70s.
Amazing. I had no idea this existed. Holy shit. Okay. Look, just the description that you just said, it feels like this is pretty much inspired by this one that I...
It's not... I wouldn't call it Clue-esque insofar as, like, Clue very much implies that kind of all-in-one location, people trying to outmaneuver each other. There's a certain type of thing that's very indicative of that's not true for Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but I don't know. What is that one? What is your number 9 or 8 or whichever?
The Thing.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that is a very funny, you're right. I can see the kind of overlap, but I would defend Carpenter.
It's very much what we see in The Thing, so...
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty similar.
It's like Clue, but you have to find the alien.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, that's a pretty good description of The Thing.
Well, thank you.
You remember the good trivia with The Thing's score was that they hired Ennio Morricone and didn't use all of the music that he wrote. And some of the unused music from The Thing ended up in The Hateful Eight. And
what? No, wait, I think I knew that, but...
Yeah, and it's awesome stuff. I remember there's this one scene in Hateful Eight that I remember I was smiling ear to ear in the theater.
But did they know that was recycled?
Yes, of course. I mean, they had to get clearance and license it and stuff.
Okay, it was not like...
No, Morricone didn't rewrite it. They literally found unused music from The Thing and put it in the... Like, Tarantino, who's like a Morricone expert, he knew that. He knows everything Morricone, and he found a piece that he likes, and he used it in between cues that Morricone wrote for The Hateful Eight.
Mm.
And it's so effective. It's so good. It was actually my favorite cue in the movie.
That is such a good movie. It's so fun.
It's very divisive. I have friends that love it and friends that hate it, but I remember quite liking it.
It was like being on a theater.
Yeah, I felt the same. I thought it was great. I loved there's an indulgence to it that arguably goes too far, but I still enjoyed that. I enjoyed, like, I saw the 70mm print version that had a 10-minute opening overture and all that, and was shown on film, and like there was what they called the roadshow version. That was like really, it was like 3.5 hours long, and it was, you know, not the normal cut, and I really liked it. Although it was funny, I remember the film strip actually broke because the theater didn't have a projectionist that knew how to do film strips. It had been so long, and the guy literally leaned out and goes, "Give me 10 minutes, we're gonna fix it." And the movie stopped, and the lights came on, and we had to wait for them to fix it. And then they fixed
it. Oh my god!
That somehow helped. It felt like this the whole movie was supposed to be this kind of like travel back in time, and broken projector kind of helped with the vibe.
You're so positive, always. I love that about you. okay, number 7. The police ask a serial killer to help them catch another serial killer.
I already mentioned this one, Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, 1991.
Is she? Oh, yeah, no, she's an FBI agent, of course, Agent Starling. Mm-hmm. I started to say, I thought maybe she was like a psychologist or something on behalf of the police, but of course, no, she's very much an FBI agent.
Yep,
classic. Howard Shore, Jonathan Demme directed that movie, but it was very much in that era where Howard Shore was most famous for these horror films like The Fly, like Existence and Videodrome and Crash, you know, these Cronenberg movies, which is why when he got hired to do Lord of the Rings, it was like, what? The horror movie guy? Because like that was what he was famous for, Silence of the Lambs, you know, ultra dark and brooding and heavy. And it's actually really effective score. I love that opening titles where it's her jogging in the forest and just the music is telling you so clearly, this is going to be just miserably dark. It's really
best
good.
Picture Oscar winner.
Yeah, which is exceptionally rare for anything that you could label a horror film. Very, very unusual. Fair. That mm-hmm. that's almost never the case.
Yeah. Number 6, a hungry sea creature likes people on vacation.
A hungry sea creature likes people on vacation. Is that not Jaws?
Yes.
I assumed you initially were talking about the the late 90s cheesy cruise ship horror film that's called Deep Rising with Famke Janssen and Treat Williams.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but we're talking about movies I like.
Yeah, well, that movie is incredibly cheesy, but it has a really cool kind of opening sequence of just this giant monster killing everybody on a cruise ship.
That's funny.
And it made for a really effective trailer, but the movie is very silly.
Yeah, I don't think that will make the cut on my 13 favorite movies. No,
certainly not. No, yeah, I forgot that it was favorites. Yes, of course. So yeah, Jaws, of course. Yeah, classic. Mm-hmm. Nothing to say about Jaws. I had no idea
this was the first blockbuster ever.
It invented the category.
Yes. Yep. I had no idea.
Yep. Caused an enormous explosion of like it made so much money. And because it came out in the summer, it created that tradition of
right.
the summer
yeah. oh,
is
yeah.
where you all do the psychology. Blockbusters.
Oh, yep. my God.
And it's funny because that movie, you know, this is very common trivia, but that was Spielberg's sort of final chance, because his previous film, The Sugarland Express, was a big flop. And it was like, you know, we'll give you one more chance, kid. And Jaws was famously like a disaster while they were shooting.
Nothing
was
God.
Working and... The shark was the mechanical shark never worked and you know that's the whole movie was supposed to feature the shark more heavily and they couldn't so
I
they
think
ended
that
up
worked so oh, that, well
I mean that's why it's like it's why every film student has to learn about this movie for all time, because it became a perfect demonstration of when you lean into less is more, you can actually be
less
scarier.
Less is more.
It's the same with same with Alien, Ridley Scott. Like, use the alien as little as possible.
You're just stealing from my mouth. Yes. I was going to mention that one as well. Yes, less is
That's
more.
Surely on the
sure.
list, and we just haven't gotten to
that,
it yet.
That thing you're saying, I don't know if you ever saw Mom. I think it's Guillermo del Toro. Let me see.
Guillermo.
Mama.
Oh, yeah. I did not see that one. Mama was that Annabelle franchise.
No.
Yeah, it is.
Franchise meaning like the people?
Meaning like there's like sequels called like Annabelle something or other.
No, blah, Mama blah, blah, is blah. Completely unrelated to Annabelle.
Are you certain?
Yes, I am.
How much are you willing to bet?
$1,000.
Wow, that is
confidence. I am so sure that Mama doesn't relate to Annabelle.
Well, the character, Jessica Chastain's character, is named Annabelle. I just looked it up here because I was curious.
Yes, but that is not related to the doll at all.
All right. Well, yeah, I never saw it, so I don't know what I'm talking about. I just know that it's the same director as the It movies.
Well, you owe me $1,000.
All right. Deal.
So, I was saying that movie, it was so good. I was so scared. And then suddenly, towards the end, we get to see Mama clearly, like close-ups and stuff. And you kind of like lose that spark.
Kind of ruins it. Yeah.
It kind of ruins it. And that, I think, is like my note for Guillermo.
He just produced it, for the record. Andy Muschietti is the director.
Right. Yeah, I just love when it leaves more to the imagination.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I love and I don't love it because, I'm a coward. Okay, number 5. A ship get visited by an uninvited guest.
That has to be Alien.
Yes. You're doing very good.
Ship is. Well, I just knew Alien had to be on your list, so I was kind of listening for something.
Yes.
And if I hadn't already been thinking about Alien, I wouldn't have necessarily made the leap to Spaceship. So
yeah.
But of course, classic.
Yeah. 1979.
Yep. Jerry Goldsmith had a very good sci-fi year in 79, scoring Alien and Star Trek The Motion Picture, the two biggest sci-fi films of the year, which are opposite in every way from each other.
Yes, for sure.
Alien is truly one of the great scores of all time. And he hated working with Ridley Scott so much afterward that he said he would never work with him again.
That is so sad.
I mean, Ridley just completely yanked around his score and changed so much about it. And look, it's the director's prerogative. Like Jerry, I think, took it a little too personally.
I think both of them, not that I know much about them, but it seems to me that both have a big ego.
Yeah, you know, Jerry, 79 was an interesting period because Jerry was starting to he was no longer kind of the young, newer guy. He was starting to move into the demographic of like the veteran who's a little bit part of the old generation. Like he was still young. He was only like 50. But, you know, when you're 50 and you've got some hits.
There's no time to, you know, I'm an artist. I'll make my art. And if you don't like it, fuck you.
That tends to be the path that that artists go down as they get older. They're less interested in the kind of young hunger. And so Jerry was like, that was like a turning point for him, I think. But also Ridley, many people have had falling outs with Ridley. So I think he's just generally difficult.
I guess, yeah, as I always say, all people have a right to be angry and cranky, and I'll always forgive them, so...
He wasn't old at the time.
How old was he?
That's a good question, but I mean, I fundamentally disagree because I think there's never a right to be an asshole, but but let's find out.
Yeah, but if you're old and tired, just accept it, you know? Just let them be.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, look, he's 84 now. Which is astonishing considering he still makes so many movies.
Wow.
But at the time, that would put him at 42. So he was almost 10 years younger than Jerry.
Well, I take it back then.
Yeah.
I guess it was an ego thing. I guess it each one was so sure of their craftsmanship that, yeah, those things can't.
I think so, to some degree at least. All right. Yeah. Unexpected visitor, check. I mean, unwelcome.
Okay, number four. A very quiet guy stalks people from afar before going on his killing spree.
A very quiet, what, Jason? Is that Halloween?
Yes.
A very quiet guy makes it seem like a very shy young man.
Well, he doesn't speak.
That's so funny.
Yeah, 1978, John Carpenter.
Yep, who also wrote the score. And definitely wrote one of the most classic scores of all time. And that is extremely uncommon for a director to have accomplished.
I don't think I ever knew that. Or I think I heard it and I didn't pay attention. But that's amazing.
Carpenter's always scored his movies. All the, like, Escape from New York and The Thing is a combo of he and Morricone. He's always been...
Wow.
He, like, does concerts and stuff. He's an anomaly. He's totally unlike anybody else. And his music... The thing that's so crazy is usually there's a couple other directors that write their own music, like Clint Eastwood and a few others, and they tend to be very generic scores because their talent is clearly as a director. Carpenter is clearly a very talented director. Like, obviously, he's made some of the all-time classic horror films. And like you saw in the news recently when Jordan Peele was being compared to Carpenter because of Nope. And Peele wrote, like, don't you dare disrespect John Carpenter by comparing me to him. Like,
oh, my God, that is so sweet. Peele was... We need to watch Nope.
I know. Oh, for sure. You know, but point being, he is a revered director. But what? Not only are his scores essentially just as iconic, but they also, they sound like him. He actually has a personality as a musician.
Interesting.
So that's exceptionally uncommon. I mean, the only one.
Is there something like you can like describe super quick before this gets too long? What is that essence that you see that you know that is him?
I don't know how to describe that for anyone in non-musical terms. It's just that the way his melodies come together, obviously, you know, the synthesized, his use of synths is very like quintessential 80s. But I think one of the defining characteristics of someone's musical personality is that you can put it on different instruments and it still feels like them. Like if I rearranged, like I one time did an arrangement of the theme to Halloween for Tina. So like even as a cello piece, it's very obviously Halloween and you can feel... There's a hypnotic kind of unnerving. Everything's always slightly off kilter. His music is never very predictable, but it's also not. It's also kind of repetitive and hypnotic, so it somehow manages to be simultaneously predictable and unpredictable. I have a lot of respect for him. I mean, no one sounds like him. I mean, he's really
interesting,
and he sounds like a guy that just kind of creates from a place of no pretension and just enjoys writing music. Nice. His music doesn't sound like it's trying to impress you, which right. I appreciate very much.
That's awesome. I had no idea.
Yeah, he's great.
Much respect.
Oh, very much.
Number three, a man who's so devoted to his mom likes to dress up as her.
Come on. I dare not even validate too much discussion on this film already.
You have to answer for our listeners.
Psycho 2.
Psycho 2. 1960.
Yes. I already told a lot of my favorite Psycho stories, so.
Cool. Blah, 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 blah. Number
was
two.
That three? Okay, yeah, number two.
A girl with a very bad language and nausea gets her room super dirty.
Look at that. Not at all. That's a summary of a scene, not the movie.
Well,
but
I know. I just like how I'm gonna explain the movies. Like a demon possessed a little girl. That's already implied, I guess.
So this is very clearly William Friedkin's The Exorcist, and that one is famous. 1973. The tubular bells. That's a licensed track that was not written for the movie. So it's like one of those rare instances where the super iconic music was a thing they essentially found and plucked in there.
It was like random, or was it from another?
No, there's a whole story of how they were struggling to find the tone, and somebody happened to get a hold of this record and just kind of tried it. And I'm forgetting the particulars, but I know that they initially hired, who was it? Lalo Schifrin, I think. Let me verify this, lest I, be wrong, because I'm pretty certain they hired Lalo Schifrin, who was famous horror movie wise for the Amityville Horror, though he was more famous for like the classic cool 60s and 70s Dirty Harry, Cool Hand Luke, Mission Impossible. He was the king of cool, and but he did the Amityville Horror and some others, and so he got hired for The Exorcist, and I'm pretty sure he recorded the score completely, and it was like supremely dramatic and heavy, and Friedkin hated it and fired him, and then they ended up piecing it together from other sources. But the funny thing was, Friedkin initially wanted Bernard Herrmann, who had become a very grumpy old man by that point, and
which is sort of fine.
And so Herrmann they screened for him the film, and they said, "We'd love for you to do the movie, and we think you could write you. We want you to do an even better score than you did for Psycho." And Herrmann supposedly said, "Then you should have made a better movie than Psycho," and stood up and walked out.
Whoa! Mic drop.
Yeah, exactly. So, needless to say, Herrmann was not offered the job. They hired Schifrin, and they ended up firing him.
Wow. Wow.
So yeah. Classic.
Amazing.
All right, you're number one of all time. I feel like I should be able to guess what's your favorite horror film, but I can't think of what it's going to be. I feel like we've already said all the ones that I know you love.
Yeah. As I said, the order is kind of there, but I'm not really sure because there's so many. I might skip a song
Grace.
That I don't.
Your number one is Grace.
I need to watch it first.
Well, let's just say it is. We know it will be.
Yeah. Anyway. We'll see. Maybe I'll something else can pop in my mind. But for now, number one is A Family Man's Psychological Breakdown.
Wow. A Family Man's... Oh, The Shining.
Yes!
Amazing. Great. Yeah.
1980.
Shining, classic.
Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah, Kubrick had a weird relationship with music, because obviously he had one of the greatest scores of all time by Alex North for Spartacus. Then they very famously had their relationship fall apart when Kubrick fired him without telling him he'd fired him on 2001. And so for The Shining, it's all licensed music and it's almost entirely classical music of the time.
Sounds,
you know,
more
Bartok
like
talk and
Quentin Tarantino.
Like very much that model of like, I just find the music I like and use it. And I don't want to deal with composers. I don't want to deal with like, am I going to like the final product? I just want to use what I like.
Yeah, you guys are all troublemakers.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there you go. That's my list. 13 movies that I like. I hope you liked it.
All classics.
You're right.
Yeah.
I would say that I have big respect for Jordan Peele.
Yeah, I mean, to me, he's a very good director, and he also is a great director from the standpoint of empowering his people, because his production design and cinematography is always amazing. Like just if you just watch Us. Every frame of that moving is like this gorgeous painting. I mean, it's just mind-blowing how attractive
so
the footage
beautiful.
Is. And Get
but
Out.
But also, I
to
think it's all combined
degree.
Because I mean, we already liked him because he's so funny. He's
well, as
just,
a comedian, Key and Peele is some of the greatest comedy ever there. And I remember I never watched that because I think they came from Mad TV, which I was never a fan of. And like it was just a little silly. It always felt like Mad TV always felt like the poor man's Saturday Night Live. And Saturday Night Live is already so hit and miss that I never got into Mad TV. And I probably missed out on some major gems as a result. Like it's my own oversight. But then when Key and Peele started, I just kind of assumed it was similar. It was like just like silly sketch comedy that I wouldn't be that interested in. And then one day I happened to see them do an interview on The Daily Show. And all I kept thinking about is these two are nerds. Like they're talking about Star Wars and Star Trek and all this stuff in like deep cut kind of ways. Like they're not fans. They're nerds. And so I started watching Key and Peele and I realized these are nerdy. This is nerdy comedic brilliance, which I immediately fell in. Oh my God. I fell in such love with them. And so then when he pivots to making a horror film, and his horror films are also like, you know, below the surface,
gorgeous,
they're very
artistic.
Nerdy, but they're also very like, they're not psychological horror like in the way Psycho is. They explore kind of like sci-fi-esque nerdiness at their edges while, you know, wrapping it in obviously a lot of kind of social commentary and that sort of thing. And I also should say, you know, our wonderful friend Michael Abels was very effectively unleashed. Jordan Peele just found a YouTube video of Michael's music and just cold called him and was like,
"Do you meet Michael after Jordan?"
I never heard of him until Get Out came out. And like
he's
everybody,
so cool.
I actually was at GDC. I heard about him before the movie came out from the recording engineer, a guy named John Rod, who I ran into at GDC in San Francisco, and I just talking shop said, "What are you up to?" And he goes, "I just finished recording a very unusual score by a guy that I guarantee you've not heard of, named Michael Abels, for a new film from the Key and Peele guy, Jordan Peele." And I was like, "Wow, everything about that sentence was unexpected." And then the movie came out, and I heard that music and that opening, like kind of evil gospel music, and I thought,
"Oh yeah,
you know, God damn, this is a guy that really came out swinging."
Oh yeah,
he's
amazing.
Such a nice guy.
Both of them.
Yeah. So anyway, that's a very.
I'm starting to have a little
a crush on Jordan Peele.
Yes, because I guess since you presented it to me, because I didn't know anything about him or anything ever since I moved to the States. You kind of like hint a little bit of his jokes, and I didn't get them until you show me what they did, and I was like, they're actually very good.
So genius. God, that Gremlins 2, that's going in the movie. Oh, the pitch meeting
anyway,
for Gremlins 2.
Let's wrap it up. Tell me what is the album of the day, because you did it last time, but I'm giving you the pass
the
again.
The honor.
Because, you are the movie guy here, so bring it.
Well, in the vein of classic horror scores, a film I have not seen in a very long time, but it's a score that comes up fairly often, especially when you talk to horror filmmakers, is the late 70s movie Suspiria by Dario Argento. It's definitely considered a horror classic, or at least a cult classic. It's one of these really fucked up movies.
I've seen it in top lists of horror movies.
Yeah,
but I've never seen the movie.
Yeah, it's in that same era as like Rosemary's Baby and movies that are just really twisted. The score is by this prog rock Italian band called Goblin, who did a number of scores, but this is like their claim to fame. So the Goblin score to Suspiria is, I decided to make the album of the day because it's in that same kind of vein as John Carpenter and that era, you know, it's prog rock. It's not 80s synthwave.
Interesting.
The way a lot of Carpenter's music is more in that vein. It's definitely closer to like Genesis and other kind of typical prog rock wow. type groups.
Are you sure this is the album that you want to?
So and it's such a classic of like horror film.
I heard those whispers and I was, yeah.
It's creepy as shit, and it's also hard to, like, every director that I've ever worked on a horror film with, seemingly Dario Argento and this score has come up at some point in our conversations because it's just so influential. It's one of those that...
Big reference.
Yeah, it's just one of those that, like, especially as a kind of an atmospheric piece, it really just stuck the landing perfectly. And so I thought, you know, I obviously come from more of a classical background, so I tend to talk along the lines of more orchestral scores, but it really, I do admire it a lot. I love it. And I like writing music like that, even though I don't get asked to very often.
Amazing.
And so, yeah, I can't recommend Suspiria.
I am so surprised that you didn't pick Jerry Goldsmith, honestly. I am just, I have no...
Well, my secret backup would be his score to the kind of psychological horror film called Magic with Anthony Hopkins, the ventriloquist. There's a cue. If you go look it up on YouTube, go look up a track called Appassionata you hear this gorgeous string orchestra and then this ugly, violent harmonica interrupts the orchestra. And it's so abrasive. That's one of those, when I bought the CD as a high schooler, I heard this music and I had to watch the movie. I was like, I just need to know what the hell this goes
with. Wow.
Because it was so bizarre.
You're a rare case because I don't know anybody that does that. I don't know anybody that has listened to the soundtrack before watching whatever. Like, only you do that.
Well, no, there's a whole society of soundtrack nerds that's standard behavior for, but... I guess I'm a little unusual in that I took being a soundtrack nerd and said, I'm going to just try to get paid for being a soundtrack nerd. And that became my life. So.
Yeah, nice. Anyway, guys, thank you so much. I hope this was scary. No, it wasn't scary. I'm so glad it wasn't scary. I actually was like, you know, looking up the information of each movie that I picked. I got a little... I had to put music, you know, in the background to not feel because the pictures that show up and all the stories. And then I saw like a website, like, you know, 10 of the most scary things that happened during the production of The Exorcist. And, you know,
there's always those.
Two people died during whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was like, oh, man, I don't know if I want to do this. But I figure a better way to approach this because I'm a coward. So, yeah, silly descriptions is what works for me.
It's great. I love it. I love your quizzes. You always surprise me with those, and they're always great. So, well done.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, next time, onward to more more horror subjects for next time.
Yes. Thank you all so much. You know, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Brushes and Kiss.
Hooray!